This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Ed Gordon is away. On today's roundtable, poverty. For 3 years in a row, the number of Americans living below the poverty level has risen. So too has the number of Americans without health insurance. The question is, can America end poverty, or at least decrease it, and how? With us today is a group of individuals who studied, reported on, and personally fought poverty. Donna Latimer is executive director and co-founder of the New Life Women's Leadership Project in North Carolina. She's one of the voices featured in a series of special reports produced by North Carolina Public Radio titled Understanding Poverty. Also with us is Jared Bernstein. He's a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, and Sam Fullwood III, a columnist with The Plain Dealer in Cleveland. Welcome, and let's get right to it. So today there are 36 million Americans who are poor by federal standards and millions more who are struggling to make ends meet. Donna, you were one of them. What was the time you most feared that your life would never change?
What was the time that I most feared that my life would never change? Was, you know, being a single mother, head of household with three children, I didn't see hope out of poverty. And that no single change would eliminate the condition, that working was not going to be enough to really change my situation.
So how did you start to take charge of your life?
You know, working two and three jobs was actually taking me out of the home and not providing adequate means of support for my family. So one of the things that I did, I began to really strategize on how to continue to provide income to my household and at the same time change my living situation. So I worked my way through school, 4 years in night school at a local university, which was, again, really, really hard. And so when people put themselves in that situation, you kind of rob Peter to pay Paul. But I knew that that was a situation that I had to undertake in order to begin to open doors and windows and crack holes for me and my children.
So let's talk about your organization. What exactly do you do? You're trying to help women in poverty in North Carolina. What lessons do you teach the women you work with that you've personally learned?
New Life is a women's leadership and business development project, and we are located in a very rural area in eastern North Carolina. The project is about creating personal leadership and business development skills to low-income women, and that we understand that eliminating poverty is just not one issue. It's a community issue. And that as a community, we have some real structural damages that has happened in our village that has to be clearly addressed from a community, a church, the educational institutions, and the government, and that this whole level of people taking responsibility for their situation is true, but it's also how systems are set up to provide the support that people really need to come out of those situations. And so what New Life does is connect the issues to the people and the people to organizing movements that will actually begin to address.
Sam, you've spent a lot of time reporting on people like Donna who are fighting poverty and people who can't seem to get out of it. Now, Cleveland has the highest poverty rate of any big city. What story was the toughest for you to report of all the ones that you've done on poverty?
You know, it's kind of hard to order rank tough stories. I can say that some were a little bit more memorable than others. I wrote about a 21-year-old young man, Brandon, who had never made a good decision in his life. Life skills was something that was lacking. His parental supervision from his own home was not good, and he was repeating some of the same mistakes. He was the father of three children by two different women, and when I met him, I began to see for the first time in his 21 years a sort of a light beginning to flicker on that he wanted something better for himself. Donna raised a very interesting point, which I think speaks to the whole question of poverty, and that is hope. In the case of the story I wrote about Brandon, he began to have hope where he had never had it before. And I think that is just elemental in giving people a chance to get out. If people believe that their lives can be better, they can work toward work toward the future. And that all requires hope. And that was probably the most memorable story, was about a person, to see that person begin to get hope to escape from poverty.
Have you done any follow-up on his life? What's happened since you reported on him?
As it turns out, I have not done any follow-up, and that's one of the things I'd like to do maybe in the second half of this year. I'm in touch with him, but I'm not in a position to report what's happened to him.
I know you're a busy man. Let's go to Jared. Now, you're with the Economic Policy Institute. You've written extensively about poverty. What's the most surprising fact or figure that you found in your research?
I think the most surprising fact, and one that speaks to one of our questions today about eradicating or significantly diminishing poverty, is the trend that occurred in the latter 90s in poverty. This was a period, say, between 95 and 2000, when the poverty rate actually fell pretty quickly. For single moms like Donna, in fact, it fell faster than it ever had on record. We started in 1995 with about half of young black kids in poverty. That's an astoundingly discouraging statistic, especially when you recognize how inadequately low our poverty thresholds are. 5 years later, about a third of young black kids were poor. Now, that's still far too high, but you can't achieve the kind of success we want, and we're discussing when you raise this notion of eradication, unless you get the trend going in the right direction. So for 5 years, we had a set of unique economic and policy conditions that really put a dent in the extent of poverty in this country, and I thought that was truly informative.
So what happened then that's not happening now? I mean, that if you had a downward trend and now you've got an upward trend, what's going on? What are the different factors there?
The main factor has to do with the strength of the underlying economy. In the mid-90s, there was a push to get people off the welfare rolls and into the workforce. In many ways, the policy was a very punitive one, and there were aspects of it that I argued strenuously against. But fortunately for that policy, the economy was headed for a set of conditions that hadn't been in place for 30 years, particularly very low unemployment. The unemployment rate actually tipped below 4% in 2000. This meant that for the first time in decades, employers were actually bidding wages up to get and keep the workers they needed. We had a massive exodus from the welfare rolls into the workforce. Lots of folks who wanted to make a good faith effort, wanted to get into work. Essentially, the kind of conditions that Donna talked about and that Sam talked about regarding hope, you actually had a set of economic conditions that provided a context for that kind of hope to be realized. Now, I don't want to overstate the case. The jobs that were available paid inadequate wages to lift people above the poverty line. I'm sure Donna could attest to that. But at the same time, there were a set of work supports that were initiated. Again, I think they could have gone further, but the government helped close some of that gap that we heard Donna reference between what people can earn and what they need. So, you know, we really learned a lot about the solution, and in many ways, it's not rocket science. There's two components.
Let me just finish. I'm sorry.
A very tight labor market with a strong job market and a set of government supports that help to meet the gap between what people earn and what they need.
Sam?
Yeah, I think one of the things that people often forget, that we need to be reminded when we talk about the whole subject of poverty, is that, you know, the Bible talks about poverty always, the poor always being with us. In this country, for most of our history, most Americans were poor. They were subsistence farmers. And one of the things that I think has changed since over the last 30 years or more with regard to poverty is sort of the way in which people who are not poor project poverty onto people who are, such that now we think of poverty, poor people, as life's losers. Which is a radically different way of looking at poverty, particularly in a place like Cleveland. It makes it all the more difficult for people to have hope when society, institutions, establishment, media descriptions of them portray them as losers in the game of life. And I think that really needs to be challenged, so that people don't get burdened by thinking that their situation is hopeless, so much so that they don't do anything to try to change that.
Well, Sam, you bring up an interesting point. You say that in the past, many or most Americans were poor, you know, by some empirical standards, but maybe didn't have some of the same baggage around it. So Is the worst thing being poor, or is the worst thing the emotional ramifications of being labeled as poor? And I want to get Donna after
without,
you.
Without question, it is far worse, the baggage that is projected onto poor people, than actually being poor. In fact, the definition of poverty is an arbitrary figure that's based on how much food people can eat. And so even in that politicizing of how we describe who is poor and who isn't, we're sort of making judgments about people, and those judgments tend to be far more debilitating and crippling to individuals than their immediate subsistence.
Donna, what about, do you think this is a big issue, the whole emotional issue?
I think it's a major issue, but I think it depends on what day of the week you ask a poor person, which is worse. You know, what I've seen over the last couple of years is that public policies have been put in place that has actually increased the poverty level of some people, from free trade to welfare reform. These policies have continued to put pieces in place to continue this whole cycle of poverty, particularly in rural areas. I don't know about what happens in cities like Cleveland, but I can talk about what happens in areas like Eastern North Carolina and across the South. And that what I've seen as a result of policies like welfare reform that was so mean-spirited in my heart, that women that was being forced from the welfare rolls were not counted as part of a workforce anymore. And because of the policies, because of the rules and the regulations that was actually attached to this policy, women became very invisible. So they no longer were part of a system where they were counted anymore as part of the unemployment, a part of the underemployment. They just became invisible to society. So I think it all depends on what day of the week you really ask somebody what this feel like or what it means to them.
Now, Jared, we've only got a few minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about the federal government's approach. Donna was just talking about, and you were talking about, mm-hmm. this whole what's been called welfare reform. It tightened up the window that people can receive benefits.
Yeah.
And some people have pointed the finger at that as one reason poverty has risen. Now, after the Great Depression, the federal government created all these jobs to get Americans back to work. And today, Congress and the president oppose that kind of New Deal approach. So given that opposition, what choices are there in order to lift poor people out of poverty, you know, through government means?
Well, first we have to, I'm very much with Indana's camp regarding this. I mean, recently, a great example of what we're talking about here is that recently the welfare rolls continue to decline year after year, even though the job market is still, if not in recession, in something that looks a lot like it for low-wage workers. Yet the Health and Human Services Department that runs the welfare programs comes out and releases press releases celebrating the decline in the welfare rolls, even while the poverty rates of single moms is going up very quickly. Mm-hmm. It's a great example of how government is out of touch with the problems that we're documenting. And I very much agree with the premise of your question. If we want people to get out of poverty by working and there aren't enough jobs and government has a role to create such employment, if not create it, at least to subsidize it such that people can who find work can lift themselves out of poverty. That's not happening. And in fact, it's so far off the agenda that I think we're moving in the opposite direction.
Sam, let's go to the whole question of race here. Now that there are certain looming potential cuts in health care for the poor in America, some rural white constituencies are petitioning the administration to say, hey, we need health care out here. We're in rural areas where, you know, we're poor. When poverty is associated with race, does it make it harder to solve the problem in America?
I think that's a part of what I was saying earlier. Maybe I didn't draw it specifically on race. From the 60s on, we have sort of flipped the script on what poverty is about. If again, going back looking at it historically, when the New Deal came into place, a lot of those policies were aimed at helping poor people, but they were aimed at helping poor white people so that no one really carried the burden of race and stigmatizing poverty as a racial thing. in the Great Society of the 60s, that was when it flipped. So that all of the liberal social policies of the Johnson administration in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement became to be associated with helping blacks. And that was even exacerbated even more so in the 80s under the Reagan administration, where welfare and blackness became synonymous and vilified completely. You heard the stories about welfare queens and people driving Cadillacs to buy steaks with food stamps. Those kinds of stories stereotyped the face of poverty as a black, as a female, as a mother, and it turned public sentiment against the poor. Such that now when you talk about poverty, people have in their mind someone who is undeserving, almost always a person of color, typically a woman, and people think that they don't deserve any kind of government support.
So what should journalists do, if anything, to try to correct that impression?
Most poor people are white, by the way. I think it's an underappreciated fact.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. That's true. But that's not the perception. And I think that one of the things that we as journalists have as a responsibility is to report the facts, to tell people what the real empirical truth of poverty is, that most government programs do not advantage black people. They may disproportionately advantage, but the wealth of it goes to help Americans who are in need. And so that we're beginning to see that now because of rural poverty, which is disproportionately white. And that people are beginning to be, some of these things are beginning to break down. But I think we've done a pretty shameful job in terms of media in making people really understand the depths and the degree to which many, many people are living in poverty.
Donna, we're out of time, but just one final sentence. How would you end poverty? One thought.
That there's no single change can eliminate poverty, that there has to be a coming together of government, of church, and of the community to begin to really address this, and that folks need to look at what's on the ground and to really begin to develop some grassroots tactics to really addressing and eliminating poverty.
All right, Donna Latimer is executive director and co-founder of the New Life Women's Leadership Project in North Carolina. She's also one of the voices featured in a series of special reports produced by North Carolina Public Radio titled Understanding Poverty. Jared Bernstein is senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute, and Sam Fullwood is a columnist with the Plain Dealer in Cleveland. His columns are collected in the book Full of It, Strong Words and Fresh Thinking for Cleveland. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.